Hi, this is Jeff Siegel, the wine curmudgeon. My guest today is Steve McIntosh, who writes the Winthropology wine blog in Columbus, Ohio. Steve's been doing this a long time, a decade or more. Steve, thanks very much for joining me today.
It's great to be with you, Jeff.
Steve, I wanted to talk to you today because you're in the middle of the country like I am. You're in a unique three-tier state. Ohio's got this hybrid system of selling wine, minimum pricing, a whole bunch of stuff. And I thought maybe we could get some insights from you about what's actually going on in the wine business and offer a little more perspective than what we see on the West Coast and on the East Coast. Does that sound good to you?
That sounds great.
Okay. So where you are, you give me the one sentence description of how the liquor business, how the retail business works in Ohio, and then we can talk about the big Tennessee Supreme Court decision and how you think it might affect those of us who actually have to go to a liquor store or a grocery store and buy wine.
Sure. One sentence, huh? As advantageous a circumstance as possible for the wholesalers in the state. How's that?
That's pretty good. But I mean, so you have minimum pricing. You can't have sales. Some stuff is still state stores in Ohio. Is that true?
So the alcohol business in Ohio is really divided clearly between spirits versus everything else. So once you get north of 40 proof, you're in the territory of the spirits business, which is fully controlled by the state. About two decades ago, perhaps a little bit longer, the state got out of the state store business and privatized that. So they closed all of their shops, issued licenses to private beer and wine shops to house and sell spirits on their behalf. But the state still owns that inventory. They control the prices and handle all of the logistics on the spirit side.
Wow. So technically you can't have a wine sale in Ohio then, huh?
Well, so on the beer and wine side, they control minimum pricing. And no one is allowed to sell, retailers are not allowed to sell beer or wine at prices below what is set by the state. So, yes, you're correct. You cannot have a wine sale in Ohio.
Oh, the three-tier system's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
All right, so we've got this big Supreme Court decision out of Tennessee, which says there's parts of the three-tier system that maybe aren't constitutional. Do you think that we're going to see a lot of change out of this? Are people in Ohio actually going to be able to have a wine sale?
I doubt it. Certainly not in the short term. We've seen legislative or case law pass before, such as Granholm, and that has not created a short-term landslide. These things require either a legislative change or in-state case law to change, both of which require a great deal of lobbying and money. So I'm not going to say never, but anybody who's hoping for something to happen this quarter, this year, or maybe even in the next 5 years shouldn't hold their breath.
So we'll still have to pay, because I know I had a reader one time who said that some of the $5 wines that I write about, because the minimum pricing in Ohio, they're $6 or $7.50 or something. So he's still going to have to keep paying $6 or $7.50, huh?
Yes. However, I would say that having done a fair bit of comparison shopping around the country, the pricing in Ohio is not uniformly higher than it is elsewhere. In fact, the pricing is pretty darn competitive. You're just going to have to suffer through the maladies of the hit and miss, where you might read about a sale in Florida, for example, on one product and it's going to be 20% higher, but that's really cherry picking. So, you know, we don't pay on average an awful lot more than anybody else does around the country.
See, and that's really weird too, because if you have minimum pricing and you're not paying significantly more, why do you need minimum pricing?
Well, the old answer was to prevent liquor or alcohol from getting too cheap and becoming a moral hazard in society. The mid-century answer was really to preserve the margins of distributors and retailers. Today, I don't know that there's much of a different answer than the mid-century answer, but we now have alcohol sales and spirit sales on Sundays. So it's not as though we're really trying to protect the society from too much.
Yeah, because you can't buy spirits in Texas on Sunday. Because we got to be protected.
Well, you should be at church, is what they're really trying to tell you.
No, what it is that the Package Store Association wants a day off where they don't have to pay their employees for 7 days a week. That's the reason that we can't buy spirits on Sunday. All right, so then let's talk a little bit about wine pricing and premiumization, which is the idea that Americans want to buy more expensive wine because we're quote-unquote trading up. And I know that you've read some of my stuff and told me that that my perspective is unique and interesting. How do you see premiumization? Is it good? Is it bad? Do consumers like it?
So my interpretation of premiumization is really that as we see greater and greater consolidation in the supply chain of wine, and what that really means to the layperson is big companies are buying up more and more of the supply chain. What you tend to see is that brands that get acquired are being diversified in terms of the particular labels that they produce, with very little difference that's visible to the public. So I'll give you a perfect example of that. William Hill, once upon a time, was a pretty decent, respected producer of Cabernet and a few other varieties in Napa Valley. They were purchased some time ago, and now at the grocery store, you can find William Hill Central Coast Chardonnay. Okay, the label is very different than it was back when that fruit was being sourced from Carneros. But what happens is it's no longer a state fruit. It's no longer the quality that it used to be. And the price is not really in line with the quality. So they're really leveraging those brands to bring consumers into the brand family at a price that is lower than what the brand used to offer to the market, but higher than what corresponds to the quality in the glass, if that makes sense.
So that makes perfect sense. That's actually the best explanation of premiumization that I have, of the failures of premiumization that I've ever heard. And the next time that I'm criticized for complaining about premiumization and blamed for all the problems of the wine business, I'm just going to refer them to you, Steve.
Happy to field those complaints.
Okay. Now that we've solved that problem, let's talk about rosé. I know we were talking about doing this. You said you wanted to talk a little bit about rosé. Is rosé like the best thing to happen in the wine business in the decade you've been writing the blog?
Well, it kind of depends on which end of the wine business you're on. If you're in the rosé end of the wine business, it pretty much is the best thing to have happened. It's a timely thing to talk about because not only is it hot and it's sort of rosé season, but I'd be hard-pressed to think of a time since I've been alive when rosé has been more pervasive in the public eye and on retail shelves. So that's a new phenomenon that we've seen growing over the course of the last 5 years. I'm sure you see it there too, right?
Yeah, no. And again, it's I take credit. I always say I take credit for two things, very tiny little credit. I'm putting my thumb and forefinger closely together since this is radio, more or less, for two things, one of which is making regional wine respectable and the other of which is the popularity of rosé, just because I've been nagging wine drinkers about it for so long. Why do you think all of a sudden rosé is popular? Because it certainly had nothing to do with the wine business because they didn't pay any attention to it until one day they woke up and discovered people were buying it.
Well, I think partly that's true, but if you look at the wine business from its strongholds year after year, you know, you're always going to have your Cabernet sales and your Chardonnay sales and your Pinot sales propping up the cornerstones of the industry. But the business is constantly looking for new tricks to bring to market because each new product or product segment offers the opportunity to goose their margins. So rosé generally undiscovered by the American consumer a decade ago, is one of those areas where the industry has been able to say, oh, well, we're no longer a three-trick pony. Let's reach over here and grab for that. And rosé is not unique. We've seen that happen in Moscato and other areas. And so I think there's been a lot of marketing attention, particularly because you can produce a rosé within 6 to 9 months of harvest and charge an awful lot more than you can an equivalent white wine.
That's an interesting point to make, and it almost makes you as cynical as I am.
I'm surprised. I'm just calling it like I see it.
I'm kind of surprised about. All right. Well, no, this is good. We got some good stuff out here. Listen, Steve, I want to appreciate you taking the time to do this. We'll have to do it again. I enjoyed this very much. Thank you.
Jeff, it's always a pleasure to chat. Thanks for having me.
This is Jeff Siegel, the wine curmudgeon. Thanks for listening. So long until next time.